Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2012 documentary film The House I Live In, directed by Eugene Jarecki. The members of the panel will include Marilyn Asher, director of the Nebraska Corrections Youth Facility, Douglas County District Court Judge Marlon Polk, Rodney Prince, Omaha resident and drug war veteran, and Jeanette Taylor, founder of Impact One Community Connection. The moderator will be Willie Barney, founder and president of the Empowerment Network and Omaha 360. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 22, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The House I Live In, winner of the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, captures heart-wrenching stories from individuals at all levels of America's war on drugs. From the dealer to the grieving mother, the narcotics officer to the senator, the inmate to the federal judge, the film offers a penetrating look inside America's longest war, offering a definitive portrait and revealing its profound human rights implications. Here now to introduce the program and the panel is Willie Barney, president of the Empowerment Network and Omaha 360.
First of all, let's recognize Film Streams for bringing this very important picture. I am Willie Barney. I'm a facilitator of the Empowerment Network and president. And we've been at this work for about 6 years. And if you've, just watching this film, you can't help but be moved by what's going on in our community, and not just in our community, but our nation. And when you hear and see some of the statistics, since 1971, $1 trillion has been spent on this war. 2.5 million Americans that are locked behind bars, 1 million of them African-American, 5% of the world's population in the United States, yet 25% of the prison population. Those are just some of the statistics that were shown in the movie. The way that we want to work this tonight, we're going to introduce each panelist, give them a chance to make some opening comments, to get their initial thoughts about what they've just witnessed and their perspective. And then we'll have a few questions for them, but then we'll also open it up for some Q&A with the audience. And we want to come back at the end, though, and talk about solutions. How do we move forward? With that, I just want to go down, and I'll give you each a chance just to introduce yourself very quickly and your initial thoughts about what you just saw. Judge Marlon Polk, let's welcome him.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. Again, my name is Marlon Polk, and I am a district court judge here in Douglas County, Nebraska. And I have been a district court judge coming up on about 8 years here in April. And this film obviously hits home because, at least on the Nebraska level, I am one of the cogs in this machine, particularly on the correctional side, because I average about 150 criminal cases every single month. And I would say about a third of those are criminal cases, and majority of what we deal with is and are drug cases and drug offenses, obviously on a smaller scale than what you would see on the federal level, but nonetheless as it relates to Nebraskans and those that are in the state judicial system, we deal with a lot of the criminal cases. And the film struck a chord because, similar to the federal Judge Bennett, I many times have to sentence a young person, not just a young person, but any Nebraskans, all races. And it is a difficult thing sometimes to go home with at night, knowing that you've had to sentence someone for a very small amount of drugs. And but yet they are paying a very severe price, not just the sentence themselves, but the fact that a lot of these young people, particularly if we relate it to young people, are leaving with felonies, which we all know has other ramifications on their lives. So the film really hit home for me in that regard.
Thank you, Judge. Jeanette Taylor, founder of Impact One. And again, let's recognize her for helping to organize this evening's event. Jeanette, you've been actively engaged in different aspects of this whole work and now a law student. But give us a quick introduction, but also your perspective on the film.
Okay. I'm Jeanette Taylor, founded Impact One, and I was the executive director until recently. This film really struck a chord with me because I've actually lived a lot of these experiences. Before being an executive director or a student or anything like that, I was a mother. And my daughter, her father is sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal prison. So this war on drugs has a lot of collateral damage, and I think people don't realize that. It destroys families, communities. These kids grow up without, you know, a two-parent household, and it has a real, like, a trickle-down effect, and we don't realize that. So this film really touched me because there's different aspects of the film that I can relate to. I know that law enforcement has a job to do, that they're here to, you know, stop crime. But being addicted to drugs is not a crime. It's not a crime. So I'm ready for the dialogue, ready to get started, but I'm ready to share also. Thanks.
Thank you. Rodney Prince, it says drug war veteran.
Right, right. Rodney Prince, I'm a father. I'm a drug war veteran, an activist, an entrepreneur. The reason I'm here is because when I was 19, I was arrested and sentenced to 121 months in federal prison. I was released at the age of 28. And my experience with the federal prison system is why I call myself a drug war veteran. So I'm here to testify to that. What struck a chord with me in this movie? I don't think that there was one particular thing that struck a chord with me in this movie. I'm just glad that the information is finally coming out, that we can finally have a discussion, that somebody put it on film so that we can pass this information around and the American people can get a chance to see what I've been seeing and what I've been struggling with for over 20 years now. There's so much inside of the film that needs to be talked about, and you know, I'm just looking forward to seeing what the people have to say and getting the dialogue started.
Let's welcome Rodney Prince. Marilyn Asher with the Nebraska Corrections Youth Facility. I know a lot of this, as well as Judge Polk, you see a direct result on the back end. Talk to us about your perspective and a quick introduction of yourself.
Well, my name is Marilyn Asher. I am the religious and volunteer coordinator at the Nebraska Correctional Youth Facility. We are a maximum security prison for youth adjudicated as adults for the state of Nebraska. The inmates that reside at our facility are all felons, and they are between the ages of 16 and 20. I have been there for 10 years, and I've seen a lot of human suffering, just like that was portrayed on the film tonight. One difference between what I see every day and what was portrayed is similar to what the judge was saying, is that with the state, we have more inmates there for violent crimes than for drug offenses, technically. But many of the violent crimes are related to drugs. Only 14% of our inmates are incarcerated for drugs. And actually, at the youth facility, we just have one inmate right now with that charge. But I see the ramifications of it everywhere. I have the good fortune of working with both volunteers and inmates. So I do see a ray of hope with the volunteers that come in. And Jeanette and Rodney have both been volunteers at our facility, and we do appreciate that. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Let's welcome Marilyn. We do have microphones, so as you have a question, and please, if you could keep your questions pretty concise to give more people an opportunity, but I want to start with something. One of the folks on the film said that this is an unwinnable war. This is an unwinnable war, and I just want to start with that. Judge Polk, from the perspective that you have, unwinnable war. First of all, is it fair to call it a war? And is it an unwinnable war from your perspective?
I guess the it's been called a war, so we might as well call it what it is in terms of that has been the government's, you know, it seems like the focus. Obviously, it came through in the film, you know, beginning with President Nixon and has carried on. So you can call it a war on drugs. And it may not be winnable, but that doesn't mean that you give up, because the question, and will be discussed tonight, what is the alternative? I mean, I don't think anyone would be advocating a society where there is a free flow of drugs and drug use and just all of that. So I don't know what the ultimate goal, whether it's winnable. I mean, you could argue that it's not winnable, but you also, on the same token, cannot give up and just allow it to, you know, just persist. Is it manageable? I think there are more issues regarding that, whether it could be more managed. If you're using and spending $1 trillion on the war on drugs, how much of that could be used on drug treatment, drug prevention, and other issues that are byproducts of the war?
Tie into that, and then I want to come to Rodney. But one of the things you hear about Nebraska is that we do spend a disproportionate amount on the back end rather than on the front end. Is that an accurate statement from your perspective?
In terms of
the funding allocated on the back end to prisons and jails versus on the front end trying to do more on the prevention side?
Oh, there's. I think that goes without question. I think one number is just that the Nebraska youth facility that we have for the youth prison, we are spending $84,000 per youth to keep one youth confined on a yearly basis. That's more than double than we are spending to keep any adult confined. So if you just targeted the youth themselves, we are spending a significant amount of money just on the confinement of these young people.
$84,000. Per person.
Per inmate, correct.
It costs $10,000 to $12,000 to put someone through school each year.
Right.
I want to come to, first of all, before I do this, Rodney hit on something. I want to come to Rodney on this. But he said something very profound, is that this is something that he knows and has lived and is finally on screen. Rodney, talk to us about this war from your perspective. I mean, what's on your heart?
Can we win this war? I was stuck on that question. I would have to look at that from the perspective of somebody who's fighting the war on the other end. You know, so government, law enforcement agencies fighting the war. Me, I'm on the other side of that. And the people that I represent on the other side of that. This war, can we win this war? I start thinking about defense first. Of course you can't win a war against somebody that's so powerful. In 1993, I wrote a paper called Did Drugs Bring the War? I was incarcerated at the time. I was going to the University of Wisconsin. They had some professors that were coming in, and we had access to Pell Grants. And one of my papers I wrote for my English class was the question, Did Drugs Bring the War? And this is how long I've been involved with trying to understand this. And what I come to realize over time, and what I realized then, was that the war wasn't about drugs at all. So when we look at it, and I say, you know, how can I win the war? How can my people win the war? How can poor people win this war? The first thing I think about is, well, first we have to go on the defense. And going on the defense means that we will probably have to stop doing the things that are criminalized. You know, so I think about the economy then. And it's a question that all of us has to ask ourselves, is what do we believe this war on drugs is all about? And I believe that this war on drugs is a means, it's a guise, but it's a means to deal with a segment of the population that's no longer needed in this society, a surplus population. The economy is transforming. Information-based technology is displacing workers worldwide. We're in the midst of globalization. We went through a period of deindustrialization. And America, with the economic system that we have, had to decide what they were going to do with the people who were no longer needed in the economy. So when I started researching some of these things, I came across the book that was written by an author in 1970 by Sidney Wilhelm, and he wrote a book called Who Needs the Negro? And it was talking about how information-based technology was going to displace workers. So when I look at this war on drugs, what I'm looking at is a choice that America made to deal with a people who were going to no longer be needed in the economy. So the first thing, if the people on my side of this war would have to do, is first stop doing the things that will land you in prison, and then you would have to find a way to connect to the economy, to the broader economy. And so when I say, can we win this war? I have faith if we just identify with what it really is.
Let me dig a little bit deeper within both you and Jeanette and open to any of the panelists, and then we'll see if there's some folks that may have a question about this. But the economic theme really was driven through this whole film. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm reflecting on is back when it was talking about the Chinese and the opium, and that there was a specific law put in place for them because they were beginning to interfere with the white workers that needed work.
Right.
And on down the line, as it was illustrated on the film, how much of this comes back to that fundamental element of employment? I want to come to you, Jeanette, and get your perspective on that.
Okay. I want to say a couple of things. First off, there is no war on drugs. That's just a catchy slogan that they use to make it seem like people are tough on crime. That's a way that they marginalize people. When you're talking about the Chinese with opium, it's a way to identify a group of people that you want to get rid of, or a group of people, like they said in the movie, that are doing well taking jobs from white Americans, that's what they said in the documentary. And so you criminalize the behavior. If they're smoking opium, now that's a crime in California, but it's not a crime in Missouri. With the Hispanics, if they're smoking marijuana, it's a crime now. So it's just, I think that that's a stupid slogan, and it's catchy. It's like, we're tough on drugs. Next thing, it'll be a war on thugs. Or, you know, I just think people use these catchy phrases to justify doing things that are unjust to poor people, marginalized people, and people with limited opportunity. So when we talk about employment, I mean, this is a big machine. So you have prison, like these prison industries, the prison industrial complex, where these big businesses go into prison. They have prisoners working for their companies, getting paid $1.13 an hour. It might be $1.17 now, an hour, working for their companies. And then their product is sold to the city of Nebraska and other cities, I know that for a fact, through their catalogs and things like that. So it's a big business all the way around. The man in this movie, he said, we went to this little small town. We said, hey, you purchase this land, you build this prison, we'll come and rent the land, the building from you, and we'll have a private prison here. So what do you think happens? Those 2,000 prisoners that are in that prison, they count towards the city's population, also counts towards the money you receive from the federal government. So it's kind of like it's a never-ending cycle. And it's not a war on drugs. This is a way to marginalize people and try to justify it by saying you're tough on crime. The employment piece is very important. One thing, like with Maryland, one of the kids that was at her facility got out, and we were able to get him a part-time job. The part-time job he had, he couldn't keep it because of transportation and other issues. You can't get a job if you say you're a felon. It's almost impossible. No one will hire you. They automatically stereotype you. You can't live in certain, like, apartments. You can't live in certain areas. I think we need to look at the broader picture of what this does. This is collateral damage from this fake war on drugs. So to me, employment piece is really important because how will you live? If you get out of prison and you can't get a job, how are you supposed to sustain yourself? That's why you have people that go back to selling drugs, because it's the only way that they know how to make money. And that economy is booming in certain areas of the town, of every town. So I think we just need to be more realistic with what this fake war on drugs really is and how it affects poor communities and the people in it.
One of the things that, going on that economic piece, it talked about an $18 billion industry is what the drug industry means to the United States, and primarily in urban communities, but now is beginning to expand into rural areas with meth and other drugs. Marilyn, you leaned forward as though there was something that you wanted to touch on. Is there Talking about now, one of the things that it talked about is the prison system is supposed to be a rehabilitation. And what I'm hearing more and more about Nebraska specifically is when dollars are tight, one of the first things, just like I said on the film, to go are those vocational skills, trade skills, and other things that are really in line to help people get skills so when they do come back out, they can be more successful. Can you talk about the state of that in Nebraska?
That is probably true. However, at Nebraska Correctional Youth Facility, which is the only prison where I have worked, I started out at 20 hours a week, and I increased to 30, and now I'm at 40, because the warden that we have right now is very active in pursuing mentoring and rehabilitative programs for the inmates, and asked me to start a mentoring program. Tonight we have three individuals from the community that have come in to work with inmates to talk about trying to get back into society, to get employment, how to do job interviews, and to try to go over that hurdle that they will be facing because they are felons. We have a lot of other programming opportunities, but we vocationally, being a maximum security prison, we are not able to have a lot of, we don't have a carpenter shop or anything like that. We do teach gardening, horticulture, and we have a dog training program. We're looking at getting a barbering program. So with the limited number of inmates that we have, we are seeking to provide rehabilitation. Keep in mind that the inmates that we do work with are violent offenders, and so some of them have very long sentences. However, not all of them do. So many of those that do not need programming need rehabilitation. I will say that the mentoring program has been very rewarding in that we do have one inmate. This is not really on the subject, but who is he's what we consider a lifer. You know, he's there for murder. And we just noticed that he was lacking direction. And so I said, why don't we see if we can get him a mentor? And sure enough, we hooked him up with a mentor who is a truck driver. He's just a regular old truck driver from Roberts Dairy who goes out of town. And the inmate's father was a truck driver, and so they just connected, and we've seen a big improvement in his demeanor. So our job is to work with those who are long-term and then also those who will be getting out.
Good. So. I do want, if someone has a question, please raise your hand real quick. Oh, perfect.
Well, it seems to me that one of the problems is the profit that can be made from arresting people and from the jails, jail for profits. That should almost be totally illegal.
Let me pose that to that was the profit motive, the business motive. This train is so far down the track. Mm-hmm. How in the world, the number of people that are paid on the back end of this, and now the prison, when I first heard the industrial prison industrial complex, I thought, man, somebody's making that up. But the deeper you look into it, and now where you actually, as Jeanette said, have prisons that are actually generating profits, and you have traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Talk about the business motive and what that means to solving this whole thing.
I want to say something. This is basically slavery in a different form. Like Michelle Alexander talks about it, but basically it's free labor. You criminalize the behavior, you lock people up, and then they have no other choice but to work in your machine because families can't afford to keep putting money on people's books when they go to prison for 10, 20 years. So that person works for the $1.17, you know, whatever it is, an hour, and they're like forced into this machine. It's basically a new modern form of slavery. What else are you going to do? If you are locked up and you have a 20-year sentence, they don't have the program for rehabilitation, what are you going to do? You are going to go work, whether it's, you know, making cabinets that are going to fill the offices of, you know, government officials, whatever it is. You're going to do that because you don't have any other options. it is big business. But what I mean, the only way that you can stop something like that is when that big business starts affecting all the other businesses out here in regular society. Then people will pay attention, because it's not just poor people who are being marginalized; it's everyone.
Rodney, it looked like you had a piece on this.
Yes, I want to say that it is big business. And I used to look at that, and I used to think that, yes, the business is the motive. Over the years, I began to understand that it, you know, the intention, you know, for me really doesn't matter. This thing is happening, and it's happening to people. And, you know, if we start looking at what the intent is, then we won't do the work that's necessary in order for us to combat what we're facing. But there's something that's bigger. When you look at the social scientists who wrote about this subject, and the people who've come to the conclusion that globalization and deindustrialization and where we are in the transformation of our economic system in this country, and the need to figure out what we're going to do with a bunch of people that don't really fit in the private sector anymore. Like, corporations no longer need manual labor. They need a skilled workforce. This was understood. Social scientists understood this. So they had to come up with a way for them to deal with the transformation as we went through this transformation process. And we're in the middle of this transformation process. When you look at, like, labor on the bottom of the economic ladder, and you look at what it's starting to look like, you know, we got a lot of precarious labor that's out there right now, a lot of temporary work companies where you have to turn to temporary work in order for you to, you know, make ends meet. And so the question comes up, is this temporary work paying a living wage? Is the, you know, the service sector jobs that we're getting, are these service sector jobs paying a living wage? You know, what skill set does UP need? You know, there's a lot of people that's unemployed in this country. It's not just the people that's at the bottom of the economic ladder. There's a lot of middle-class folks that are losing their jobs. We see it. We turn on the news. We see that the economy is in trouble and that there's not enough jobs for people who are graduating out of college. So what about the jobs for people who don't have a skill set that a corporation is going to need? See, they understood that this was going to be the case and that America had to transform its economy, and the world is transforming its economy. What are we going to do with those people? Well, they've seen the example of what happens when people are living in a prolonged state of poverty in the 60s. And this war was started with Nixon when he became president, because they've seen the riots that took place when people said, we can't live in this prolonged state of poverty anymore. We have to do something about this. So this is when we start seeing the war on drugs being declared and what happened was you started to criminalize the behavior of poor people. And then you control these people through the criminal justice system. I'll always say that mass incarceration is a dragnet cast across our community to arrest the potential of our future leadership. Well, why do I say that? Because we don't have leadership. Like, even in the homes, just imagine, you know, if this dragnet is swept across the community and you're taking fathers away from their family members, so you don't have that person that's inside of the home that can guide the family and tell the child what the child is supposed to do, you know, as the child has to take his or her place in society, you know? So the potential of our future leadership, I think that what happened was drugs, we started to use drugs, trapped in these ghettos, trapped in this prolonged state of poverty, we use drugs. Some of us use drugs for the attainment of the American dream. Others use drugs because it was an escape from our everyday reality. What we have to come to realize is that poor people are no longer needed. Unskilled people are no longer needed, I mean, not poor people, because that's just the condition, that's the circumstance. But people without a skill set are no longer needed in the private sector in this country anymore, in the economy. And we got to figure out what we're going to do with all those people who don't have the skill set to work at a UP or any one of these other corporations in this city and throughout the nation. How are we going to train these folks? You know, how are we going to give them a job?
I want to go deeper. I know there's a couple questions from the audience. But I want us, when we come to solutions, we really need to dig into that, because mm-hmm. from the research that I've been looking at, a lot of times you hear this question: did the breakdown of the family cause these other issues, or did the this unemployment situation create the breakdown of the family, which then drove other social issues? And there are people that come from different extremes on that. And I want to come back to that whole conversation about the employment piece and how do we deal with unskilled as well as skilled labor. Question right here.
I was reminded in the part in the film where there's a prison employee who says that everybody's got to have an enemy. And so I'm wondering, in this war on drugs, who's the real enemy? And why in America does nobody talk about, you know, the big criminals? My question, though, is about the prisons. How much percentage-wise would you say of your just the drug aspect are low, mid-level type of criminals? How often do you actually see, like, somebody who actually is transporting enormous amounts, you know, the big kingpins come through the prisons?
I will say from my perspective, the majority of criminal defendants that I see that are in on drug crimes are very low level. They're users. And if they're selling, they're just selling to feed their habit. They're not the big time drug dealers. So I'm seeing user level drug dealers, drug users. And then again, if they're selling, it's just to feed the habit and just kind of to keep things moving. So not seeing, you know, the big high-level drug dealer.
So from the movie, which, again, $1 trillion has been spent since 1971, and from what we're hearing, it is the low-end offender user that's typically being arrested. It's not the so, again, $1 trillion, but we're still not getting the folks that are really navigating through most of the stuff. There's a person in the back up here. Yes, sir.
I'd like to make a quick comment, and I'd be interested in the panel's reaction to this. The thing I noticed that seemed to be missing in this film was really getting to the effect that the war on drugs has had on artificially escalating the price, the street price of drugs, to the point that it is a huge economic opportunity that it just drains resources and people out of the community and is self-perpetuating. That's why coming to the question of can the war on drugs be won? No way, because as soon as you take some guy off the street, there's somebody else ready to go, and the higher the price gets, maybe it's riskier, but there's somebody there to play the game. I'd be interested in the panel's thoughts on that.
So did the war drive up the rates and create an $18 billion industry that then drives us even further?
Yes, and it's getting worse. It's getting worse with our with post 9/11, and just the way that agencies, FBI, DEA, and all these organizations, these agencies that fight crime, what they're doing to kind of put a chokehold on the informal economy. Because what happens is that if you box out of the formal economy, then you're going to turn to an underground economy. It's difficult now for members of poor communities to get access to these drugs. That drives the price up because you can't transport them anymore because of all the profiling and everything else that's taking place. So what you see now is you see the people who don't fit into the formal economy turn into the underground economy or the informal economy and have to deal with so much in the informal economy. Yes, the price is higher now because you don't have access anymore. So it's not an option. It's becoming a situation where it's not an option. And then that's when we can bring into some of the other things that's really destroying communities is in order for a community to function, Willie, and you're familiar with this, that we have to establish collective efficacy. There has to be a shared value system, shared norms and values. But if we don't have mutual trust with one another, and this trust is being undermined every day with police tactics that are saying, you know, I caught you with this, or I heard you on the telephone talking about XYZ, the only way that you're going to get out of your circumstance is if you tell on your brother, your cousin, whoever else was working with you. You're going to have to give us information on them. And this is the reason why The incarceration rate went in the 1970 to 250,000 to now over 2.5 million. So to answer your question, yes, the informal economy, there's a chokehold on that now. So people are standing around like, what am I going to do? You know, where am I going to get a job? Am I going to have to work at Burger King? Do I have to go to the temp service? I can't go to the underground economy on no more because I don't know who's telling. I don't know who's, you know, I don't know what to do. And this conversation you can hear every day on the street corners with people confused about what they're supposed to do. And I think at that point right now is where we need leadership to stand up and say, you know, how do we deal with this socioeconomic circumstance? What am I supposed to do? Those are the answers that we're not seeing being given on the street level. Like, what am I supposed to do to deal with this? And people are making their choices, and it's just, you know, it's the same old thing. And the cycle just continues over and over again.
I always want to say, just in general, it talks, they mentioned it in the documentary. They said that it's like a person going to work for a company when you're in a company town. Like, this is the big company of this town. And it's a rational decision to sell drugs because that's the only flourishing economy in this small little sector. So you're right. You might take one drug dealer off the street, but there will be another one to replace it because that is a form of it's a functioning economy in a really deprived, depressed neighborhood. And so it's big business on both ends. It's big business for drug dealers, and it's big business for, you know, the prison system. So
I want to get to another person and come back to you. Go ahead.
I was just getting ready to mention that portion of the film, too, where they said that it's a company town. It's a real logical thing for them to start dealing in that kind of industry if that's the only industry thriving in the town. I was thinking about places like Detroit where it's a car town. Everybody in the town worked at the GM factory. So I thought that was very interesting. My question to Jeanette, earlier you were saying that that drug use is not criminal, and I just wonder if you would expound on that a little bit.
It's not criminal. People get addicted to drugs for various reasons, and they kind of depicted that in the documentary. And it's kind of like what Rodney spoke about earlier. If you're living in a constant state of poverty or you're living just in depressed living conditions in general, you're going to want to have some type of release or some type of escapism. So people, they kind of are drawn into drugs. The only real issue with that is that it's not ever treated. And they mentioned that in the documentary where you have, I think it was like 90% of the people that are sentenced for drug crimes are African American, but like 97% of the people that use drugs are Caucasian. So a lot of it is just basically they're not being treated. They're being treated as criminals. And like from my own personal experience, my stepdad was charged as if he was a drug dealer, and he was addicted to crack. And he was charged, and they, on top of just, you know, having this possession of drug charge, they threw in the fact that he had a terroristic threat because he was out of his mind, you know, when the police actually arrived and he was saying crazy things to him. So it's almost like instead of helping someone or trying to help them through an addiction, we criminalize the behavior and then we throw the book at them. He's not a violent person. He's not a criminal. He was addicted to drugs. I mean, he's since been clean for many, many years, but for a long time, if he would get arrested while he was high, they would make him into, you would think that he was like Tony Montana from Scarface, but he was basically just someone who was addicted to crack. So that's what I mean, that it's an issue. It's an issue when you treat people who are addicted to drugs as if they are, you know, kingpins. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, quick question. It was alluded to earlier, but I just kind of want to see what the panel's reaction is to it. Someone mentioned where is the kingpins at? And then also in the documentary, they talked about law enforcement, and then they talked about the actual dealers. But there is that blurry line that Rodney alluded to earlier. What's going on with these informants who are given deals to avoid the mandatory minimums, to avoid these harsh penalties? They're given deals if they catch all these little guys, which fills up the courtroom. But these guys are walking around in this blurry area of potentially law enforcement or potentially street dealer. What's going on with that, and is that a real circumstance?
I'll just be really quick. That is definitely a real circumstance. When my daughter's dad was sentenced, he was actually caught with five other people. And those five people all turned state evidence against him. None of them received any time. I think one lady got like probation for a year, and he received 17 and a half years. But they were all in cahoots, all planning to, you know, take these drugs into Omaha. And he's the only one out of that entire crew that got 17 and a half years. Everybody else got off with either like light probation, or some people had straight up immunity because they were willing to testify and basically throw him to the wolves when they were all in cahoots on that. So that happens every day. We see it every day, and people just don't talk about it.
This was touched on quite a bit in the film, unless somebody else has a response. Mandatory sentences. It was huge on the film. Judge or others, talk about the reality of that, and how are we going to address that, the mandatory sentences, the time frame, anything to be done, just any perspective on what's going on in Nebraska with that, and then what do we do about that?
Well, on the state level, we do not have the mandatory sentences for drug use or drug crimes. Like, that's a federal issue. On the state, that we have, I guess, a range of penalties that the judge himself can decide what a particular individual may get as a sentence. So we are not, bound like the federal system is, where you just have, they basically have a grid where if all of these factors come together and it equals a sentence, that's what you get. And but, you know, fortunately, at least on the state level, we do not have that.
So you feel you have the discretion that you need in order to do what you need to do regarding the drug offenses?
Absolutely.
Rodney?
There's just something that I have to mention about the federal system, and I was arrested in federal prison. The only way that you can get a lighter sentence is if you enter into a 5K1 deal, and that means that you have to agree to cooperate with law enforcement substantially, and that means that you have to find someone to inform on if you don't have somebody to inform on. There's a movie that's about to come out with The Rock. He's going to star in it. It's called Snitch, and it's going to deal with that phenomenon. The only way that you can get out of your mandatory minimum sentence, and remember, okay, let me just give you a little history. This was my first offense. It was a conspiracy to distribute charge. I was 18 when I got arrested, 19 when I got sentenced. I had to do 121 months. The only way that I would have got less than that 121 months is if I substantially cooperated with law enforcement. Now, I was the lowest person within the organization of people who were indicted on my case. I did the most time. Everybody else decided that they wanted to cooperate. I didn't. They were out within 1 or 2 years. Me, the first-time offender, 121 months.
Thank you.
Hi. I appreciate the emphasis on family. Mm-hmm. And I guess I have a couple comments. First, I'm a citizen who's doing research in juvenile court, Douglas County, Nebraska. And in reading these case files where people are losing their children, which definitely impacts poor and minorities in Omaha, it is amazing the drug problem that we have that is unreported. At least I'm not reading about it in the newspaper. And meth is definitely a part of that. So I'm interested in what you have to say about that. And then, Jeanette, you mentioned the prison industrial complex. What about how that relates to the child welfare industrial complex in Nebraska, which we are a state that removes children from their homes, third highest in the nation?
I'll just say that basically that's big business also, because kids that are sucked into the system, people who are foster parents or people who take care of these kids, they receive monthly stipends and they also receive other benefits. So it's a vicious cycle. As far as the prison industrial complex, it devastates communities, it devastates families, and then big businesses, they receive a profit. It's sad because, like, when I actually look back on it, me personally, I never used drugs, so I didn't have that issue as far as raising my daughter. But my daughter has never in her life ever had her father. When he came out of prison, he was only out for a short period of time before he resorted back to selling drugs and got caught up again. And next thing you know, he is 17 years. And it's basically because you become so marginalized and you can't get a job, you can't find a place to live, that you resort back to what you know. You resort back to the economy that pays you. And because of that, like, we are all, like, he says he's a drug war veteran. I guess I'm an insurgent then, because I'm dealing with the same thing, like, just on a from a different perspective. Right. Because my daughter now is involved in this stupid fake drug war, right, and she doesn't have a dad. So she's being raised by a single mom. And when you talk about the welfare system, I was just really blessed. And I'm kind of a nerd, so I like school. So that worked in my benefit. And I ended up, you know, getting degrees and getting decent jobs. So I was able to raise my daughter without being sucked into that system. But it was very hard. And I don't think people pay enough attention to, like, this. It's kind of like a just this crazy avalanche that once somebody gets sucked into the system with drugs, their families are affected, their kids no longer have both parents, the other parent is pressured into making more money to take care of that child or just doing things that actually take them away. And you saw that in the documentary with the lady, I think her name was Nanny, where she was working with this family in New York while her kids were in, I think it was Connecticut, without their mother. And her son ended up being addicted to, I think it was heroin, and he died from that eventually. But it's kind of like just a domino effect, and I don't think people are really cognizant of how that kind of plays out in poor communities.
See, I think that one of the things that the film did not delve into that I see is, from all of the criminal cases I've done, the profile is pretty similar of what I see, particularly when we're dealing with people of color. I do not see dads in the courtroom. If their sons are up on charges, there's never a dad to be found. I would say in 98% of my cases, I do not see dads in the courtroom. I also do not sentence people who have gone to college. I sentence high school dropouts, those who barely made it out of high school. That's what I sentence. I do not sentence college graduates unless it's on a drunk driving charge, other than that. So it sounds real simple, but that is what I see on a daily basis. I don't see dads, and I don't deal with people who have been to college. And it is, you know, it's real simplistic, but it's almost as simple as that. You know, so as I talk to young people and deal with young people, just from the angle of the system that I'm in, I am real pro-education, because from what I've seen in the 8 years, if you have that, particularly beyond high school, I am not seeing you. And for me, with young people, I don't want to see you. So the push for education to me, in the simplistic form, that's where it comes down to: dads and education. And obviously there's a lot of other problems and things that go with that, but that's what I see on a daily basis.
I just want to say really quickly, the reason that I believe, and some other people, that you don't see dads is because they're in prison. Because it's a cycle and it never ends. And we saw that in the film where the man, he basically broke down in tears. He was selling drugs, his son was selling drugs. And he said, I have two children. He said, I have two children and I don't know how to be a dad to them. And his son was looking at like 20 years. And he had just served himself like 10 years. So it's kind of like a cycle that never ends. And I think the reason you don't see parents is because, even in like the parents I deal with, a lot of them are caught up in the system themselves, so they can't be there for their children. So we just have to be more cognizant of that. And it takes a village to raise a child. We all need to step up and be responsible for the young people in this community. So
I'm getting a sign that there's one last question, and then I want to give you each a chance just to very quickly. You've touched on some solutions, but specifically, what can we do to move forward? Yes.
Yeah. Hi. That's sort of what my question has to deal with. But first, I want to thank you guys again for taking the time to organize and hold this panel. So I have a two-part question. With such a multi-causal issue and with so many different kinds of organizations out there like LEAP and Normal and all the different organizations. I'm curious as to what each of your opinions are as to what, like, the number one thing your average Omaha citizen can do for these issues, and then also what strategies you've seen work for communities in the past.
Thank you for your question. Lead us right into solutions, and we do have one other question that we'll get to very quickly. Go ahead.
I will say the number one thing that we have to do, and this is for everybody, is for us to understand that this is a economic issue, that leadership in our community can't do their job unless they address the economic factor in this. So if we're looking at our economy and we know that our economy can't absorb everyone now, then we have to push our elected officials, we have to push business leaders to act responsibly. We made a choice to deal with people that were no longer needed in the economy in a certain kind of way. What we have to understand is the American dream, everyone's included in that, and that we have to make sure that people go to school, they get educated enough for a corporation to want their labor. We need to push for a jobs program, even if we have to turn to the public sector for a little while until we make this transformation. We have to understand that we need to push and push and push our elected officials and our corporate leadership to make more room for people, make more room for people in the economy. That's what we all can do. I think that's the front lines of this war there.
I would like to say that as an individual citizen, take care of your children. Take care of your grandchildren, your nieces and your nephews, and pay attention to them. My sister was raising her three young children, and she got frustrated. And I said, listen, you're saving the state $60,000 a year per child. That's when NCYF only costs $60,000 a year. So don't underestimate what you're doing with your own families. And then reach out beyond your own family and volunteer, whether it be at the Open Door Mission, which is doing, by the way, doing a great job reaching out to families, trying to do some preventative work, or at my facility. I might as well give a plug for the need for volunteers. But I just think the integrity, the individual integrity that you have is extremely important in these days.
Maybe we'll take this other question and then we'll give a chance to wrap up. Sam?
What to do? There are things we can do. There are things that are being done in states all around the country. Basically, it's harm reduction, and it's harm reduction by sending fewer people to prison. We send fewer people to prison by changing the Nebraska sentencing laws. And we get that by some people need to organize a broad-based coalition to support that, which includes conservatives who don't want to pay the taxes for this, and liberals who are more interested in the justice issues. The entire faith-based community is likely to sign up for this and support this. You get a really broad-based coalition. You work in all the different legislative districts, and then you go through their criminal code and find those parts of the sentencing and good time and everything else where there are opportunities for getting people out of prison and not keeping them in there so long. 2 years ago, I was at a conference, and I saw this incredible presentation by the Director of Corrections in Mississippi. And they have gotten a lot of people out of prison. They have to actually change the laws. And then there are other changes in parole. It's being done, can be done, but some people need to take the lead and just build a broad-based coalition of conservatives and liberals. It can be done.
Thank you. There are definitely solutions. You know, the city and the county are moving forward. I see Tom Warren, the former chief of police, and now at the Urban League, is leading some initiatives for juvenile alternatives to keep people out of the system in the first place and give them alternatives to be here on the ground doing work and getting into programs. There are others I see around the room that are doing various initiatives to move us in the right direction. But I agree with you, Sam, 100%, that we've got to continue. This can't just be a one-night dialogue. We have to really continue to move forward. I know Rodney and others have been on the forefront of this. And we need to keep pressing and making sure that we are creating those employment opportunities, educational opportunities, and everyone has a role. Whether it's a protest role or a partnership role, everybody has a role. I know we're out of time, but I just quickly, let's recognize again, let's thank our panel for coming in. And I'm more than willing to continue not only the dialogue, but how do we continue to move forward on action? I know some will have to leave, but if there's any other panel, I told you I'd give you a chance to kind of close out just very quickly. We'll go down the row here.
I will just quickly say that at the Nebraska Correctional Youth Facility, we have a high school. All inmates are required to get their GED or high school diploma. And we also have faith-based volunteers who come in and do parenting classes. If anyone is interested in any of the other programs that we have, I do have some pamphlets with me, and I would be happy to give you one. Thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn.
I would just like to say that we need to push. We need to push our elected officials. We need to push our corporate executives to, you know, open the economy up. Let's figure out how we're going to deal with people who no longer fit in the economy. We have to address that issue. It's not only affecting poor people, it's affecting middle-class people now. We don't want to be the country that says, hey, we're going to control, manage, and contain those people that we no longer need with a criminal justice system. We want access for everybody. We want everybody to have an equal opportunity for education, and we want people to have access to this great economy that we have.
Thank you.
I'm going to quote somebody in the documentary. There was a man who said that you have to be concerned with the person down the street, because if their rights are violated and compromised, then eventually your rights will be violated and compromised. And I think people just need to keep that in mind when they're allowing things like this to happen.
Thanks again, Jeanette.
And Joe. I guess I would echo what Marilyn said in terms of trying to take care of family. That I feel my toughest job is not being a judge, but it's being a father of three kids. And that is kind of what I hope my legacy is. There's been a couple of judges who recently passed away, and their obituaries talked about how many life sentences they gave out to people. And I was thinking, my obituary, I hope they don't even mention I was a judge. I'm trying to be a father of three children, you know, and keep them, you know, obviously progressing forward. So I'm real big on trying to take care of the family.
Thank you very much. Again, let's recognize our panelists. And thank you.
You've been listening to a special program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2012 documentary film The House I Live In, directed by Eugene Jarecki. The members of the panel included Marilyn Asher, director of the Nebraska Corrections Youth Facility, Douglas County District Court Judge Marlon Polk, Rodney Prince, Omaha resident and drug war veteran, and Jeanette Taylor, founder of Impact One Community Connection. The moderator was Willie Barney, founder and president of the Empowerment Network and Omaha 360. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 22, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Scott Kuhl, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.